Welcome to the GoTo Podcast. In this episode, Dave Farley speaks with author of The Art of Unit Testing, Roy Oshrove, for a deep dive on how to approach unit testing. GoTo gathers the brightest minds in the software community to help developers tackle projects today, plan for tomorrow, and create a better future. Stay up to date with the latest in tech through GoTo's top-rated events held online and in person in cities like Amsterdam, London, Copenhagen, and Chicago, and by subscribing to the GoTo Conferences YouTube channel, where you can find thousands more high-quality dev talks. Learn more at gotopia.tech.
Welcome. My name is Dave Farley. I am an independent consultant and I'm interested in software engineering, continuous delivery, and in the context of this conversation, particularly automated testing. I'm here talking today with Roy Oshrove, who's written some great books around the topic of automated testing. And we're going to talk today a little bit about his view on unit testing and his book on unit testing. So welcome, Roy.
Hey, Dave. Good to meet you and good to be part of this.
So tell us a little bit about your book and your the art of unit testing and what that's focused on.
So the art of unit testing is now, I'm currently writing the third edition of it, but the original book was published in 2006, back when I only had two kids. And well, actually, I had zero kids and it finished when I had two kids. And then the second edition, I already had another child. The third edition, I promise, will not have another child involved. And it was based, so the first two editions were written in C#. That's the world that I felt the most comfortable to write in. And they're basically a detailing of all the, you know, that they say that you learn the most from your mistakes. So all the mistakes that I found myself making throughout various many different projects throughout my career, and kind of summarizing them into a few main parts, where the first one is separating the idea of test-driven development from good unit tests. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, these are two different skills and they can be learned separately. And the second one is the idea of categorizing, or the three pillars of unit tests, which are readability, maintainability, and trust. And the last part of the book is about connecting the company culture into the world of unit testing, because that's where I found, after you get through the technical stuff, is how do you actually get people to go and start doing unit testing or TDD or any other stuff? How do you accompany it into the organization is a very, very difficult part. So the third edition is in JavaScript, because I wanted to learn JavaScript, and the paradigm of functional programming can have a different effects on the design and the way that we do injection, et cetera. So that's currently in progress and it should be done hopefully by the end of, in a few months.
Yeah, I was particularly intrigued by your take on separating unit testing from TDD, because that's not a way that I've thought about it in the past. Well, I've seen them as separate things, but I haven't thought about the quality of the tests divorced from TDD. One of the things that I like about TDD is the way it gives me feedback on the quality of my design as the design evolves. But I did like your take reading through the book on the focus on the separate tests. One of the things I really enjoyed early on in the third edition of the book is the idea of the exit points, and that was an idea I sometimes teach TDD and sort of have some stuff around the different styles of tests that you can write, but I liked the idea of exit points. That landed with me nicely as a focus for the tests. I wondered if you could just explain that a little bit.
Absolutely. And I'm happy it landed, because I've been trying to explain the way I think about, I've been trying to find the right words of entry points and exit points for, you know, for over a decade. And then it kind of landed, you know, when you explain something enough to enough people, at some point the patterns begin to emerge in your head and you're like, oh, this wording seems to match. So entry points and exit points, It actually started from the idea of what is a unit, and I wanted to define unit in the context of a use case, or basically kind of a black box inside the system, and a use case that has entry points and exit points. So an entry point is, in unit testing terms, would be the act part, the thing that you invoke, where you first enter into the system and you start the process, or the, whatever use case it is that you're doing. And the exit point is the behavior or the results that you get. And the exit points can be divided into three main categories, as far as I could see, which is either you get back a value. So if you invoke a function, you get back a value. So the entry point also acts as the exit point. The second one is that you change the state of the system. So the behavior of the system changes. So you might use a different function to verify that the system behaves differently. For example, if you're logging in, if you're adding a user to the system, then you should be able to log in with the new user. And so the unit spans these two functions that are related to each other, the entry point and the exit point, and they're using the same state. And the third one is calling a third party, a logger or any kind, so sending an email, for example, anything that we don't want to have, that we don't have control over, that would like to fake in our tests. And so these three exit points then map into a bunch of other things. They fall kind of like Legos in my head, because now I can start saying if each exit point is a different behavior of the system, it can be mapped as a different requirement, as a different story, as a different test.
And so I think that was the one of the things that I liked, was that the focus on I think you say at one point that you should write a test per exit point. You know, whatever the behavior, even if one piece of behavior results in multiple exit points, you write a test per exit point. And I think I've been doing that, but I hadn't thought about it that way. So, and I think that clarifies it in terms of ways of explaining it really nicely. The concept of there being a kind of behavior under test, but you testing that in different dimensions, is kind of an interesting one and a useful one, I think.
That's cool that you're connecting to it. The whole point of this is that we should be able to, you know, to talk, use the same language to explain why we think something is a good idea or not. And whenever I look at someone's test, when I do code reviews, et cetera, I want to be able to explain to them why I think they should separate it into two different tests. And the way that I am able to explain it now is more easily to say, look, you have, you with the same entry point, you're now testing two exit points, which totally makes sense. But each one of them is tested separately and each one of them can fail separately. And so it makes sense. So it's not about having multiple asserts in the test, which is what I used to actually write in the first edition of the book. And it totally did, you know, it fell down because that's not what I actually meant. I meant one concern per test.
I've had the same problem in that I too have used the language, you have a single assert per test case. And that's kind of right, but it always felt like it wasn't quite capturing the value, because I've had people say, but what about if I need, you know, I've got one thing with two properties and I want to assert both of them. I'd treat that as okay, as testing those things together, but this other thing was not. And the idea of focusing on the exit point kind of clarifies why I was uneasy about some kind of combinations and not about others now, I think. So I really did enjoy that. The other idea that you kind of touched on, which I think is important, both of us are true believers in the importance of automated testing as not just an after-the-fact review of the behavior of our code, but a way of organizing our development approach, I think. But certainly, as far as I'm concerned, test-driven development or even unit testing hasn't caught on as much as I would have expected. If I'm a bit hardline and I believe that, you know, we're not really doing a professional job if we're not covering the work that we do with automated tests. So you touched in your description of the book, you touched a little bit on the problem of getting the developers to adopt these kinds of practices. So what help us, what more can we do to do that, do you think?
I think this is the part that, to me, these days, other than, you know, writing a technical book, I think that the part that the most amazes me and intrigues me is how humans behave, because I think that is essentially the biggest challenge that we have as leaders, as coaches, consultants, whatever it is we are. Each one of us at each company wants to do the best thing, but not only in their head. They want other people to also do the same thing. So influencing behavior has been one of the areas that I really have really cared about in the past few years. And I've learned a lot about it. And I wrote about it in my book about Elastic Leadership. And I also plan to include parts of it in the third edition. And I've started to talk about it in the second edition as well. And the idea, and there's a book called How to Change Anything. And I can put a link to it maybe later on. But the idea in the book that to me really translated nicely is that there are six influence forces that actually enable or, let's say, disable a behavior. And we usually, as technical people, we just look at the first two, which is the personal ability of someone, or do they actually know how to do that something, and the personal motivation of a person to do something. And we assume that if I just convince the person it's a good idea and I teach them how to do it, then everything else just falls like dominoes. And the reality is that a lot of times we have those conversations and people, yeah, agree with us and they learn. And then the day after, everything goes back exactly to the way it was. And nobody knows why the hell everything got stuck. And to me, what that book presented is those extra two categories, which is the social, the people around the person, social motivation and social ability. How do people react around the person? Who does that person follow? And lastly, I think the most important for us is systematic influence. So the reward system in the company in which you work. What do you get evaluated on? What are the metrics that people care about? Which behavior will give you a better salary at the end of the year? Doing this way or doing the other way? So the reward and punishment system at the company, the way people are evaluated, that's one. And the physical structures around the person. So, for example, showing up to a meeting very late because you live very far away would be a physical example. Or having, you want to do people to do pair programming, but all the desks have this kind of, you know, those round desks with, you only have room for one person to sit next. So no one can sit next to you. So those are physical things. And to me, including that type of thinking checklist to try to understand why people don't actually change their behavior is a huge factor in getting, in at least understanding why I'm failing to change behavior, and then having a to-do list of, okay, so I guess I need to change this, or I'll need to talk to the people in charge of this for this to be able to change. And at least I'm not stuck anymore. At least I'm not just facing an invisible wall and I don't know which windows I need to open. That's the very least. Yeah. So that's kind of the spiel of it. And in the book, I plan to specifically give tough questions and answers for people that usually care about them, such as how long will this take? And what happens if my estimates become too long? Will people actually stop listening to me? A lot of things that are related to those things. And I plan to connect all the dots together for that. There is no one thing. Each organization is different. Each person is different. And that's the key thing, is that we need to have a set of very small decision-making skills on what to do in specific situations when a person has a specific problem. And then we kind of analyze it. I hope that kind of answers the question. Maybe I've been too generic. I'm not sure.
No. I agree. I agree with an awful lot of what you said. I don't disagree with any of it. It was making me think about some of the teams that I worked on. One team that in the back of the one that I nearly always think about when I think about teams doing well is we spent an awful lot of time on things like, we want to rearrange the desks so that everybody that's working closely together can talk to one another, and so that, you know, I can just kind of turn around and pair with somebody over here or over here, you know, those sorts of things. And those little tiny things, the physical constraints and the social constraints, make a big difference on the way in which teams start to think about themselves and think about what good is, I think.
Those small things are huge. You know, we're all remote right now, but when people still worked in offices, having the dashboards and showing the build statuses physical on top without you having to log in, that's a huge difference. That's a physical environment. It also creates peer pressure. There's a lot of things that happen that, so people aren't crazy when they say, I want people to work close to each other or, work to do pairing. It creates a different dynamic. Even remotely, I've been able to do a bunch of pairing and remote mob programming with teams. And it was a completely different experience than just having a meeting and setting up for 30 minutes and then talking about something. Just open mob programming for 9 hours, and then people can come in and out as they like. Kind of work nicely.
I think you and I are enjoying this bit too much. We should probably move back to the unit testing focus of the book in case.
Yeah, and I wanted to challenge you with a small question on my end then.
Yeah, go ahead.
So far, we are agreeing with each other quite a bit. Is there anything that you didn't agree on? Is there anything that you thought, you know what, I'm not sure I'm crazy about this idea, or I'm not convinced about it, or anything that was... I would love to hear that.
There wasn't anything in the book that I saw that I disagreed with. I wouldn't have written a book like that because I would have started from test-driven development. It's not that I disagree with any of the things. It's just that I think that all of the ideas that you said are amplified by test-driven development. I don't think that they are in any way reduced. The thing that I prize test-driven development more highly than I prize the tests that I write. And the reason for that is because I can think of almost nothing else that gives me the same kind of feedback on early feedback on the quality of the design that I am producing. Working incrementally and driving my design through tests, allowing it to grow and evolve as my understanding grows and evolves, seems to me the real value behind test-driven development. And the tests themselves are incredibly valuable and incredibly important, but they are secondary to that value to me in terms of the impact that they have on my approach to development. So I always think about it and approach it from test first, test-driven development. That's kind of... I am programmed to think that way, but that doesn't in any way diminish any of the things that you say. The ideas, and as I said, the idea that I'm definitely stealing is this idea of the exit points for the tests, because it's just a nicer way of talking about it than any that I've seen before. But there's a lot of value in all sorts of different descriptions, I think, in the book that. I can't think of anything that I read that I thought, no, he's talking rubbish here. I didn't think there was anything like that.
I wanted to share you a bit of my dilemma, why I chose to not write about TDD. I mean, I basically just talk about it in the first chapter, and I cover it. And the fact that I do it almost on a daily basis is definitely part of the way that I work. But there are two reasons that I chose to separate it. The first is, books about TDD already existed when I wrote it, and they were very good. And there was nothing else I wanted to add to them that actually brought some extra value. And so just repeating them in a way that was okay. So that's 2%. Maybe the graphics would be better. the real value to me is the value that I wanted to... Well, let me start by the opposite. One of the biggest challenges that I think people are having in learning TDD is because TDD to me involves three different disciplines, which is writing the test first, writing good unit tests, and good design techniques. And so when people try to get TDD and they end up having to learn all these three things at once, and it's a huge wall to climb, and a lot of them just don't end up climbing it because it's too difficult. I wanted to separate one of those skills and say, okay, look, even if you just learn the unit testing and then you can add on the TDD, or you can learn both of them, but realize that why you might have an issue is because you're trying to learn all these things at the same time. And no one can learn all these things at the same time and be productive. You actually also have to have a job at some point. And so there are good books about design. There are good books about TDD. Books just about the act of unit testing didn't exist when I was writing this. And I really missed just that sole purpose of the thing. And I think it's also the point of it was to say, okay, you can give yourself a break and say, I'm going to learn this. And this is a smaller thing. And it's easier for someone who's new to this to climb up that smaller step. And then you can jump on to, you know, some of the more advanced books, et cetera, and the TDD. So that was kind of a focus. And I think that was one of the main reasoning. That's why when I teach TDD, I teach TDD training as well, just like you do. And when I teach TDD, I have to choose what to focus on. And I cannot just focus on all these skills together. So I teach TDD and I teach some refactoring up to a specific point, such as single responsibility, et cetera. And I teach good unit testing practices. That would be like the 70, 20, 10 in a way. And then there would be a separate training specifically just about design and refactoring for people that already have that experience. And I find it goes over easier for a lot of people.
No, I think that's a very good point. And I definitely think that the book has that focus. And I absolutely recognize your point. From my perspective, the interesting part, the hard, no, I shouldn't say the interesting part, but the difficult part, the challenging part is the incremental design and the ability, and when I teach TDD, one of the things I spend a significant part of the time teaching design rather than anything else, because that seems to be what the students in my classes need more than anything else. The mechanics of automated testing are relatively straightforward, but the philosophy is deep. And as I say, I think that the giving people different ways to think about it, you know, is a good way in. So I enjoyed the book and the ability to be able to separate those things out. But I must confess, it's not the way that I have thought about it before or come at it, I guess.
Well, that's good. It means that it's unique. I think that's I agree. We all bring something. We're supposed to bring something different to the table. Our own point of view. Yeah, absolutely.
One of the things in the book that I wondered about, so you advised people to avoid using mock objects where they could. You said in the draft of the third version, you said this. And so what's your objection to using mock objects? Why would you very clearly say that you use them yourself and you would choose to use them under certain circumstances, but your advice, I think, if I can paraphrase it, is that you would prefer not to use them if you can find a better way. So could you just explain that a little bit?
Sure. So I think this relates again to the idea of the exit points, where we had the three types. We had return value, we had state-based, and we had third party. And third party is where I would exclusively use mock objects. And then everything else, I would try not to use them. And the reasoning is, and this comes from kind of there are these two main approaches to mock objects. And I definitely come more from the, let's call it the Detroit school, which is the more functional way and less of the object-oriented design way of creating the interaction. So let me just explain. The way I've always worked with mock objects is to verify only the absolute end of an interaction, which is the exit point. So just sending the email, but not everything up to sending that email, an object that talks to an object that talks to an object. Every time I've tried that type of approach, I ended up with tests that are very, very brittle because they verify internal implementation that tends to change over time and for a business sense is not important. And so what happens is that the design or the way the objects are designed is not designed through mock objects in TDD, but they're designed basically from a design sense but not through a TDD for dysfunction needs to be called three times. I try to avoid verifying how many times a function gets called, how many functions don't get called, etc. Because those type of strict mock objects, to me, create relatively unsustainable testing code that people have to fight over for the next 10 years. So, for example, someone changes some internal implementation, and then you have 100 tests that are shouting at you, "Oh, you didn't call this function, and you didn't say that you're not going to call it." And so you actually have to go to 100 tests and start changing it. And just the act of maintaining those tests, I think, is unsustainable over time. And I think it removes a lot of the benefit that it was trying to create originally, which is test-driven design of object interactions. So I just limit my mock objects to the end exit point, to the end interaction. And everything else I'll verify is state-based behavior or value-based. And to me, that's a more sustainable way of creating tests that are a bit more future-proof, because maintainability of tests is one of the absolute critical things that break projects, especially if they have hundreds and thousands of tests, and then they are afraid of changing the code. And that's the thing that I'm trying to kind of enable, is to have future-proofing tests as much as possible that still bring value, that break when they should, and don't break when it's not important.
I think that's a really good explanation. And I would also say that kind of calls out another one of these kind of design points. It's one of the kinds of feedback that I look for when I'm sorry to go back to TDD again, but when I'm looking for TDD is, you know, if I've got that kind of chatty interface that I'm trying to mock, it's telling me that I've got the coupling wrong between the thing that I'm chatting to and the code that I'm trying to test. And so at that point, I'd be looking to refactor the design to improve the separation of concerns between the thing that I'm talking to, that I'm mocking, and the thing that I'm working on.
And by the way, this goes to a learning that I've had just in the past few years. You know, I've been looking at this assumption of mine about, you know, mocks are overall by default have a balance of negative unless you find the exact right spot, to kind of what you just said, which is no, but the whole point originally was that if it is so chatty, then you end up with, you create a different design so it's not as chatty, etc. Or you end up with an endpoint exit point, basically. It's a way of achieving that. Realistically, what I'm still seeing, though, is that a lot of the designs that I end up consulting for already exist. They cannot be changed, and they're already chatty. And so there is no, so if using mock objects automatically creates this huge unmaintainable mess in the test. So the other sense is that most people don't have a good design sense enough to say, oh, this is very chatty, I should change the way the design behaves. And so because that's missing, the bar for having a maintainable test requires highly good sense of design. And I think that's a very high bar for a lot of people in organizations. Unfortunately, I wish it was better. So I don't think it's realistic to ask a lot of people to do this when, you know, TDD is difficult enough without the design part, as they say. So what I wish is that it wasn't just like 5% of the developers that had that type of sense of, oh, I have this book, these books in my head about good design. And so when I come across this, I'll have not only the good sense to realize that I should not have a chatty interface and change it, I should be there right at the right time when it's being created, not by other developers. And I should have the sense that I'm allowed to change this type of design. Like, there's so many things that have to go right for that design to change. So that by default, I think mock objects, for all the other places where it doesn't happen, there actually is a unmaintainability that ends up happening. And that scares me. And realistically, pragmatically, I'd rather have less of them because the risk is smaller, even though there is less of a design push for internal interface design, if you will. So it's kind of a, you know, that's why I've been struggling with it in a way.
Yeah, I think that's a good kind of pragmatic point. But I do think that's kind of surfaced an area where maybe we do just slightly disagree, just in nuance. So I agree with your analysis of the world. Well, most people are not, most developers are not thinking sufficiently about the quality of their designs, for my taste at least. My view is that test-driven development gives us a tool that kind of starts to force you to think a little bit more about the care that you take with your design, and because you suffer the consequences, and the consequences are that you have these hard to maintain tests. That's because the design's poor. That's because you've got bad design, and so we can start to use that feedback and learn from the feedback that we gain as we're writing the code and running our tests, how to start to improve our design. We've also got to culturally, as a group, start talking more about design. How many conversations do you get involved with developers where we're arguing about whether this language is better than that language? I really don't care. I care much more about the nature of the designs that we implement, whatever the choices, the technology choices that we make are.
But given that, given what you've just said, and I agree that I would rather live in that world than push people towards it. Even in our other, in the world of hardware, let's say if you have a chainsaw or you have a box cutter knife, they do come with pieces of plastic around them that protect you, because people running with knives and scissors can be scary. And by default, you know, when you have to put on boxes, you know, this is a Superman suit, does not actually allow you to fly, you know that people are in trouble. So we should, I think that realistically, pragmatically, we should be pragmatic about what we demand in a way from people and say, okay, maybe in 3-5 years, I think it will be realistic to say, maybe it's time to go back to a mock-driven API. But realistically, in most projects, there's so much learning to be done anyway that the wall, even just to teach at this point, is really hard. So yeah, ideally, we absolutely agree. There is something to it. Realistically, you know, even for me, it would be difficult at this point to learn that language of interface design through mocks. I think it's more complicated, and maybe just means I'm not as good as a developer, you know. But that's what scares me. I don't want it to be kind of, if you can't do that, then don't even bother. I want this to be kind of an open playground where people come in and they feel comfortable, you know, learning these things and getting better. And at some point, maybe jumping into some of those extra design, but actual design is difficult. It's difficult for all of us. Like, how many people will actually understand, you know, the difficulty of mock-based API design versus mock external, you know, and have actually experienced both cases? There aren't a lot of people that have, you know, had both of these experiences. And so it will be almost impossible to explain the pain without going through that. So I don't know. It's a tough subject.
I think that's a fair point. It's probably just me tilting at windmills, hoping to improve the quality of design. So I think that's reasonable. I've enjoyed our conversation. We could carry on talking about this stuff and go into more nerdy detail. There's lots of stuff that I was hoping to get into, but we're kind of running out of time. So I'm just going to say thank you very much for having this conversation with me. I've enjoyed it.
Oh, thank you, David. It's been a pleasure. And, you know, it's always good to talk to someone with your type of experience and knowledge and gain feedback and, you know, have these good conversations. Thank you very much for having me.
Pleasure. And thank you to GoTo for facilitating the conversation.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the GoTo Podcast. Head over to gotopia.tech to discover lots more content from the brightest minds in software development.